Hid walk-in closet with shelves and drawers and hangers arranged to display the great-grandmother's wardrobe to its best advantage, some of the outfits displayed on vintage dressmakers' forms. Wow! I'm sure this isn't part of the original house. Too new.
You're right. Mr. Baggins-Toes had it especially built for this collection.
He motioned for me to step into the closet, then oddly put his finger to his lips and pulled the door closed.
Hey, what do you think you're doing?
I pushed against the door.
Shh, he hissed. Room might be bugged. Listen, I'm only going to say this once.
I listened.
You know why I'm here. To ID the paintings for the cops. That's all. Anything else I see here is none of my business. I'm a convicted felon. There are certain things I can't afford to be involved with. You understand?
I think so, yes, I said, starting to feel claustrophobic inside that closet full of old black clothes.
Okay. I'm going to show you another collection that's not on the tour.
He rattled the papers Claudine had given him.
But I'm not going to say anything about it. And you're not going to write anything down about it. Got it?
Got it, I said, not really getting it at all, just wanting to get out of the closet. He opened the door, and reading from his script, returned to a normal tone of voice.
Mrs. Baggins-Toes's great-grandmother was a young widow when she joined the women's rights movement. She never married again and wore black all the rest of her life in mourning for her husband. That's why all of these clothes are black. All of her hats are black, too. They make up a separate collection. I'll show it to you next. But first examine these outfits as much as you like. They are all perfectly preserved, top-quality designer pieces, and span about 40 years. Mrs. Baggins-Toes enjoys wearing some of them occasionally.
I moved to touch a 2-piece velvet suit displayed on a vintage dress form, marveling at the tiny waist the woman must have had, when Madigan, with finger to his lips once again, pushed a row of clothes out of the way, revealing a sliding panel. I had just enough time to click off one shot of the suit as he moved the panel aside, long enough for me to see what was in the 2-foot-deep area behind the closet's false wall. Then he closed it and repositioned the all-black, old-time high couture on the adjustable wooden hanging rods. It was an odd contrast of collections, the rows of soft, luxurious fabrics providing cover for the rows of hard metal guns.
Okay, then, we haven't much more time.
His voice was brusque, businesslike.
On to the hat collection.
He pulled open the door to an adjoining room.
She actually has a whole room devoted to hats.
I still hadn't moved away from the dress closet, trying to process what I'd just seen and why he'd shown me the hidden guns. I was aware of his voice, reading once again from the script. The words droned on about the importance of hats in women's wardrobes in the late 1880s and early 1900s. How the hunting of wild birds to harvest their feathers for the millinery trade had nearly wiped out the entire snowy egret population of the United States. The more recent hats were smaller and plumeless. Sean said early environmentalists had succeeded in stopping the bird hunting practice. I tried to focus on Sean Madigan's recitation, forced myself to pay attention to the hundreds of hats displayed on tall wooden stands. Wide-brimmed bonnets decorated in elaborate concoctions of silk flowers and satin ribbons vied with plume-covered hats, some of them topped with entire stuffed exotic birds. It was fascinating and heartbreaking at the same time. I had to turn away from the evidence of the sad slaughter of so many beautiful birds. Instead, I looked at a round, marble-topped table where a tall, delicately painted porcelain vase was displayed. No, not a vase. More like a large round sugar shaker with holes in its top. I had a quick flashback to a round Quaker Oats box stuffed with long, sharp knitting needles. This round container, though, was filled with long, sharp, jeweled hat pins. Chapter 45. I could hardly wait to leave, to call Pete, to try to make sense of what I'd just seen. I checked my watch and almost sighed out loud. Still almost 20 minutes to go. I struggled to pay attention as Sean narrated, with what sounded like real enthusiasm, some history about a room full of gorgeous Oriental furnishings that a 4 times great-grandfather of Claudine's had brought to Salem from China. It really was a beautiful display, definitely museum-worthy. If this show idea ever actually happened, it would be good TV. I was sure of it. My hour was finally up, and I followed Sean down the grand staircase. I peeked into the room where Claudine had greeted me, but the recliner was empty. Seeing my questioning glance, he said,
"Claudine has a doctor's appointment. I have to drive her there. Something about her knee. I'll let you out."
He held the front door open.
"I guess I'll see you tonight at the rehearsal," he said.
"See you there," I said. "Thanks for the tour. It was interesting. It's quite a place."
"You don't know the half of it."
I stepped out onto the terrace and he closed the door firmly behind me. I backed out of the driveway, probably a little too fast. I wanted to call Pete right away, but realized that we'd probably need some time to cover everything I needed to tell him. I checked the clock on the instrument panel. 3:10. I barely had time to get to my hair and pedi appointment. The phone call would have to wait a little longer. At 5, with toes pretty in pink and hair tamed, styled and smelling good, I pulled into our garage. The Buick was there too, so I knew my aunt was back from the library. I'd already laid out clothes to wear to the rehearsal dinner.
"Nothing too dressy," Shannon had said.
The dinner after the rehearsal was going to be at Turtle Cove. Mr. Dumas is a big fan of their local seafood. I'd promised to tell Aunt Ibby about what I'd seen at the Bagginstose house. There wasn't anything I had to tell Pete that she couldn't hear, too, so I decided to save time by calling him from her place. I could catch her up on the details about the clothes and those hideous hats later.
"I can tell by your expression that you're excited," she said, as soon as she opened the kitchen door. "Tell me all about it."
"I will," I said, tapping my watch. "I'm going to report to you and Pete at the same time. I'll put the phone on speaker, okay?"
"Good idea," she said. "Time saver."
Pete picked up on the first ring.
"Are you okay? Did you run into any trouble? Jesus, Lee, do I have to worry about you every minute? Maybe this new job isn't a good idea after all."
Hello, Pete," I said. "Haven't got time for a lecture now. I have to get dressed for the wedding rehearsal. I'm fine. Your friend Madigan watched me every second. I found out some stuff you need to know."
"Oh, babe, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to lecture. I know you're smart and savvy and capable and all that. I just worry, you know?"
"I know. I worry about you, too. You're a cop, for goodness sake. I worry about you all the time. But listen, this might be important."
"Okay. Shoot."
"I've got you on speaker so Aunt Ibby can hear this too, okay?"
"Yes. Hi, Ms. Russell."
"Hi, Pete. Marilee is excited about something."
"Here it is," I said. "Claudine wasn't able to give me the tour herself, so Sean Madigan did it for her. He says he talked her into it so he could keep an eye on me. Said you asked him to. Did you really?"
"I did. What's the matter with Claudine?"
"Arthritis in her knee," she said. "Sean was taking her to the doctor after I left. He had a script so he could tell me about the clothes and furniture and all. In the great-grandmother's room, there's a big, modern walk-in closet. He said Elliot had it built to display the clothes properly. Anyway, when we were inside the closet, he pulled the door closed behind us." My aunt gasped, and Pete cursed.
Oh, stop it, you two. It was nothing like that. He said the room might be bugged, and he wanted to show me something.
What was it?
Pete, there's a secret panel in the back of the great-grandmother's walk-in closet. There's another whole collection behind it.
Collection of what?
Guns, I told him. All kinds of guns. Big ones, little ones. They're mostly hung up on a pegboard wall. I only got a peek. Maybe just a few seconds. But it's full of guns. I took a picture of a suit that I think must show a little bit of the panel. I'll send it to your phone if you want to see it.
Might be useful.
He said,
Yes, send it when you get a chance.
I will. That's not all I saw, Pete, I continued.
Go on.
The great-grandmother had about 1,000,000 hats, all black, mostly ugly feathered things that take up a whole room. There's a round vase thing on the table. It's full of hat pins. I'll bet some of them are 1 foot long.
Hat pins, he repeated. That fits, doesn't it? A tiny hole like that would be easy to miss, even by the M.E.
Right. And the tiny holes would bleed on a dog but would heal up fast.
Oh, dear,
my aunt said.
What are you going to do, Pete, about the guns and the hat pins?
I'd like to get a warrant right away, search the place,
he said.
But I need to wait just a little longer until Madigan finds all those paintings. Claudine's been bringing them out from somewhere one at a time for him to appraise and identify. He hasn't been able to find where she's got them stashed. That old place must be riddled with secret panels, underground tunnels. God only knows what else.
How long do you think you should wait? I asked.
A day or two is all we can delay. Sean thinks he can get some information from Claudine about everything. It looks as though the old woman has a bit of a crush on him.
I think she does, I said, remembering the flirty flapper dress, the comment about getting lost in that big house, the little giggles when she spoke to him.
I've got some undercover guys keeping an eye on the place, watching the comings and goings. You know, we can wait a little bit.
Oh, my, sighed my aunt. A crush on a young thief, and poor Elliot barely in his grave. Dear Lord. Is there really no propriety in Salem anymore?
Pete and I made arrangements to get together after I got home from Marblehead. I stayed at Aunt Ibby's long enough to tell her about the dresses and gowns and tiny waisted suits and the fabulous Oriental furniture I'd seen. I told her about the hats, too, and she already knew about the decimation of the birds. I dressed in a long blue crinkle skirt and off-the-shoulder white blouse, and added a concho belt, turquoise necklace, and beaded sandals. I put on my makeup, trying hard to remember the tricks I'd learned from Carmine. The results were pretty good. I drove slowly, only peeking at the vanity mirror a couple of times, and arrived at the Dumas's a little early. Hilda and Maureen were already there, as were 2 handsome young friends of Dakota's I'd never met before. Both Hilda and Maureen were clearly delighted with the groom's choice of ushers. The minister hadn't yet arrived, nor had the best man. Poe was apparently ready for his duties and perched happily, untethered on Mr. Dumas's shoulder, nibbling on cashew nuts being fed to him by hand.
"Looking good, Red,"
Poe commented. "Thank you," I said, realizing that I was becoming accustomed to having conversations with a pid crow. "You look good, too." The minister arrived at exactly 7, with Sean a few minutes behind him. It was a beautiful evening, the sun low in the sky, the ocean calm, the sand on the beach still warm. A few seabirds hopped along at the water's edge, and there were no crows in evidence at all. After a few false starts and much giggling from the bridesmaids, we were all in our rightful places. A wooden boardwalk, leading to a pretty little altar decorated with potted stargazer lilies and red anthurium, had been constructed since I'd been there last. Dakota stood at the altar facing the rest of us. Hilda and Maureen walked with their escorts, and I walked beside Sean.
Shannon followed on her father's arm, and Poe, tethered once again, rode on Mr. Dumas's shoulder. As a group, it turned out that we followed instructions nicely. We finished in a short time and gathered in the gazebo for a champagne toast to Shannon and Dakota before heading to the restaurant. I asked Sean politely how Claudine's visit to the doctor had turned out.
"The doc says she has to use a cane," he said. "She's not happy about it, but I think she feels better."
"Hope so," I said, moving away from him and looking toward the water's edge, picturing what the Wiccan ceremony for Megan might look like from there. "That's something I'd like to see," I murmured.
"What? What would you like to see?"
I hadn't realized Shannon was standing so close to me. "Oh, I was thinking about the Wiccan funeral tomorrow night," I told her. "I've never seen one. I'd like to, but I guess you have to be a Wiccan to witness it."
"Oh, I don't think so," Shannon said. "I bet I'd get a good view from upstairs in my house."
I turned and looked at where she pointed.
"See the window in the middle? Right under the pointed eaves? That's my room."
"Bet you could," I said. "But you'll be in the Virgin Islands on your honeymoon tomorrow night."
"I will, but you won't," she said. "I'll leave you a key, and you can go up there and watch it." "Why not? It'll be cool."
I was hesitant. "What about your dad? Would he mind?"
"Nope. He won't be home either. He's leaving after the ceremony for a job in Washington, D.C. There won't be anyone here overnight except Poe. The lady who takes care of him until Dakota and I get back isn't coming until the next morning." "Do it. You know you want to."
"I really do. Thanks, Shannon."
"It's the least I can do," she said. "If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have met Dakota. I'll leave a key under the conch shell on the patio."
When we all left for the restaurant, the sky was beginning to darken. I looked back at the gazebo, glad that it was empty. No man dressed in black marred the view. Chapter 46. Dinner was delicious, as expected. I wasn't seated beside Sean, so I didn't have to have much of any conversation with him. It was a happy group that night, as it should have been. Shannon and Dakota made a perfect couple, we all agreed on that. With promises all around to go straight home and get a good night's sleep so we'd all look good for the wedding, we headed for our cars. I'm still not sure whether I imagined it or not, but I kept catching glimpses of a green Toyota in my rearview mirror. Of course, there are lots of them around, so I was probably just being a little paranoid. I called Pete as soon as I got home. "I'm home. It was really nice. Can you come over so we can talk?"
"You sound serious. Anything the matter?"
"Oh, no. I mean, I don't think so," I said. "It's just that we haven't had a chance to have a real conversation in what feels like months."
"I know what you mean. Feels that way to me, too."
I heard the smile in his voice.
"I know you've had dinner, and I ate at Marie and Donnie's, stuffed manicotti."
"Yes, Pete's sister and brother-in-law are named Donnie and Marie."
"Shall I bring ice cream for dessert? And should I bring my tux, so you can make sure my tie is on straight in the morning?"
"Yes, to both tux and ice cream," I said. "Chocolate this time?"
"Chocolate it is. Be there soon."
Within less than half an hour, Orion announced, by tearing down the hall and out the living room cat exit, that Pete's car had arrived. I opened the door, and with a garment bag in one hand and an insulated ice cream bag in the other, Pete leaned in for a kiss. I hung the tux in my closet beside my black dress while Pete secured the ice cream in the freezer. We took time for a proper kiss, then took our accustomed seats at the kitchen table.
"Tell me what's going on," he said. "In detail, not little bits and pieces."
"Better get the notebook out, then," I said, only halfway joking. "So much has been happening. I don't know what's important and what isn't." He took me seriously. The worn notebook appeared on the table, along with a sharp yellow number 2 pencil.
Any more visions you want to tell me about?
Sometimes they seem to lead in the right direction. When I talked to Victor Protector about what he might have seen outside the magic shop, he told me the darndest thing.
He did? About what?
He told me he isn't going to protest witches anymore. Claims one of them pushed him and made a burn mark on his back.
I remembered the woman in black with the red shawl. Do you believe him?
He showed it to me. A damned handprint, plain as day, right on the man's back. He claims it was a second-degree burn.
You told me you saw a woman touching him when we watched the news. Bridget Bishop, I said. She's angry about witches getting killed. It's not a good idea to tick off a witch as powerful as Bridget Bishop. I guess our friend Victor learned that.
Are there any more visions you don't understand that might lead us somewhere?
He closed the notebook.
Off the record.
There is one. Megan showed it to me. It was at the bridal shop, I began. You know those 3-section mirrors they have?
He smiled. They have those in men's stores, too.
Right. Anyway, Megan gave me this vision. She was on one side of the mirror, I was in the middle. Bridget Bishop was on the other side.
Full-length visions?
Yes, life-sized full-length. That was a first. This involves something that goes back a while. There's a book, a real book that once belonged to Bridget Bishop. It's her spell book. He looked skeptical with that one eyebrow-raised thing he does.
The actual book from 1692?
Yes, it's true. Ariel Constellation had it at one time, and now River has it. Bridget wants it back.
She told you this?
Yes.
Go on.
I asked Megan how River could give it back. She showed me in that smoky crystal ball I told you about before.
The Wizard of Oz crystal ball?
Yes. It's going to happen on the beach behind the Dumas' house. Tomorrow night. Midnight. River will give back the book. The crows will disappear. That's what this has been about all along. The damned book. He nodded slowly, got up, and took the ice cream from the freezer.
Want chocolate sauce on yours?
No, thanks. Just the ice cream, please. Do you believe me?
Have you ever actually seen this spell book?
Yes.
I believe you.
I have a chance to watch it happen, I said. To watch when River gives it back to her. He put the bowl of ice cream in front of me and handed me a spoon.
Can I come with you?
I don't think so. I'm afraid it might not happen if you're there. Bridget isn't fond of lawmen.
That's true. Will you be in a safe place?
Absolutely. I'll be inside the Dumas' house. It's a very solemn religious ceremony, you know. Nothing bad is going to happen. Oh, one more thing about that vision. You know how there are 13 witches in a coven?
I've heard that, yes.
In the vision, there were 14. That bothered me at the time. It still does.
Did Megan explain that?
He asked in almost cop voice. No, she just smiled and waved and disappeared. I don't think I'll be seeing her in any more visions. I'll miss her. I was surprised to feel tears welling up in my eyes. Pete handed me a paper napkin and went back to the freezer.
Any more of that vanilla ice cream left?
I dabbed at my eyes with the napkin. Sure. There are some of Aunt Ibby's peanut butter cookies in the cabinet, too. He filled a bowl half with vanilla and half with chocolate ice cream, added a couple of cookies, returned to the table and moved his chair closer to mine.
Don't cry, babe. If you're right about all this vision and witch stuff, it'll be over real soon. And if Madigan can locate the last of those hot paintings, that'll be over too. When I get the warrant, I'll find out all about the gun collection behind Grandma's petticoats, and we'll take a close look at the hatpins. We can concentrate on what actually happened to Bagginstose, and on who took those shots at Chris Rich.
Another thing, Pete, I said. Remember when I told you that River blamed herself for the deaths of the three witches? Because she'd had bad thoughts about them?
I remember.
Christopher Rich is blaming himself for at least one of them. He thinks he put a spell on a fellow witch. Chapter 47. It's amazing what talented professional wedding planners can do with 100 yards of beachfront property in a few short early morning hours. Pete and I arrived at 10:30 for the 11 o'clock ceremony. A red carpet lined the wooden walkway, and the altar itself now displayed an amazing canopy of white capiz shells, which spun and jingled in the breeze. The entire walkway and altar were banked with roses, red and white, all arranged in tall, shiny black vases. The gazebo now housed the wedding cake. The fabulous Fabio, in full chef's regalia, stood beside the towering concoction. Balloons in fanciful shapes of starfish and octopi and sharks dangled from the roof, just as they had in my vision. And garlands of fragrant white jasmine wound around each pillar. A huge white tent had appeared on the opposite side of the house, which I assumed must be where the brunch buffet reception would take place. It was tempting to stand there for a while just admiring the perfection of it all, but Maureen and Hilda grabbed me by the hands. "Come on up to Shannon's room," Hilda said, pulling me toward the house. "We need to help her with a veil. Doesn't everything look amazing?"
"I hope when I get married it will be this perfect," Maureen said. "If I can ever find a guy like Dakota."
I hadn't been inside the Dumas' house before, and knowing I'd need to find my way to Shannon's room in the dark that night, I paid particular attention to my surroundings. "Where's Dakota getting ready? And the two handsome groomsmen?" I asked, as we passed through a beach-themed living room toward an open staircase of knotty pine.
"They're all over in the guest room next to the aviary," Maureen answered. "Mr. Dumas is over there getting the leash on Poe, and Mr. Madigan is there, too. It used to be his room, you know, but he thought Poe talked too much."
"So I've heard," I said. "Poe seems to think he knows me, calls me Red."
"That's so cute. Here we are. Her room is right at the head of the stairs. Wait till you see the view she has of the water."
"That works out well for me. I'll bring a small flashlight. Tippy-toe up these stairs to the first room I come to." "Perfect." Maureen was right about the view. Even with Shannon standing before a full-length mirror in her gorgeous Vera Wang gown, it was hard not to look past her toward the panorama of ocean, sky, and beach.
"Lee, can you help pin the veil a little bit back?" Shannon said. "So the spray of baby's breath holds it in place?"
"I think so." I made the adjustment she asked for, then stood back, admiring the effect. "He's a lucky man," I said. "Let's go downstairs and pick up our bouquets. I can hear Poe chattering down there already." Hilda and Maureen were at the window. "Look, the boys are already lined up at the altar, and the minister is there, too," Hilda said. "Men in tuxedos look so handsome, don't they?" There was a tap at the door.
"Sweetheart, it's Daddy. Let's go."
Folding chairs that had been set up for the guests were nearly filled. I looked around and spotted Pete in an aisle seat in the last row. I've noticed that firefighters and EMTs and other first responders often do that too, in case they have to move in a hurry. Aunt Ibby and Mr. Pennington were seated near the center of the area. Therese, wearing a black and white print, moved around as unobtrusively as she could, the ever-present video camera recording the happy event. My bouquet of red roses was tied with an enormous white satin bow. Hilda and Maureen each carried white roses with red bows, and the bride's bouquet was an absolute confection of white roses and white orchids with cascading ivy. The familiar strains of Mendelssohn's Wedding March sounded, and a cute little flower girl, Dakota's niece, with a basket of rose petals, led the procession. Smiling faces turned to watch as Hilda and Maureen fell into step behind her. I followed them, and behind me, Shannon, on her dad's arm, approached the altar. Poe, safely tethered and riding on Mr. Dumas's shoulder, bobbed his head right and left, as though acknowledging applause. The plan was for Shannon to hand her bouquet to me, then untie the tiny gauze bag containing the rings from Poe's foot, take them out of the bag, and give them to the best man. Then her dad would slip the empty bag into his pocket, and he and the crow would sit in the front row while the ceremony continued. At the appropriate time, Sean would give the rings to the minister. The words, "With this ring," would be spoken, and the two would be as one. Everything worked. It was amazing. The bird did his part and didn't make any inappropriate remarks. The rings slid onto the individual fingers smoothly. The kiss at the altar was romantic without being slushy. The bride was radiant, the groom ecstatic. The only problem for me were the dozens of shiny, black, smooth-sided vases I had to pass as we retraced our steps back toward the house. I'd just started back up the aisle, my hand resting lightly, politely in the crook of Sean Madigan's elbow, when the pinpoints of light and the swirling colors seemed to bounce from the vases into my line of vision. It was a really brilliant display, impossible to ignore. I tightened my grip on Sean's arm. He looked down at me, curiosity in his glance, but kept on walking.
"You okay, Lee?"
he asked. "I'm okay." I wanted to get away from the vases, but couldn't. Our little procession along the narrow aisle moved slowly, as Shannon and Dakota paused every few steps to acknowledge a guest, speak to a friend. These visions were uncommonly clear. No clouds or mists. The pictures were as sharply defined as a high-definition motion picture would be. First, I saw the young girls. There was no sound, but open mouths and contorted features showed me their screams, as they writhed and rolled on a rough wooden floor. They wore drab-colored long dresses, grays and browns, and each of them pointed at me with accusing fingers. The pictures moved from one vase to the next, distorting slightly at curved sides and coming into clear focus on the surface of the next one. I saw a group of women. They stared at me, faces sullen. With my free hand, I gestured to them, "Help me!" They turned their backs. I saw a man wearing a white wig with long curls. How strange. The girls appeared again, more of them this time, more tortured and terrified than before. The girls pointed once again, and the man banged a gavel on his tall desk. Then I was in a dark place, with a dirt floor and a small barred window. There were other women there with me. Strangers. All of them wept. I knew I was on a beach in Marblehead. I knew I was holding the arm of a man beside me, yet, at the same time, I was in those pictures on the vases. I stood in a wagon, grasping the sides to keep from falling. The sun shone so brightly I closed my eyes against it. The wagon lurched to a stop beside a tree. There were people gathered around me now, the sullen women, leering men, a few wide-eyed children. Dear God, don't let the children watch this. I looked up to heaven. I saw the noose above my head. Chapter 48. We'd reached the last row of folding chairs, and Sean's voice seemed to come from far away.
"Pete," he said, "something's wrong with Lee."
Pete slipped his arm around my waist.
"It's okay. Thanks, Sean. I've got her."
He fell into step beside me, and the three of us continued along the aisle as though we'd planned it that way. I felt myself smiling, nodding to guests, returning to the real world, away from whatever dark place I'd just visited.
"You saw something?"
Pete whispered.
"Something bad?"
"Yes," I whispered back. "It was in the black vases. All of them."
"You all right now? Want to go home?"
"Oh, no. I'll be fine." I turned to Sean.
I felt a little faint for a minute. I hope I didn't scare you, Sean.
You turned pale and squeezed my arm. I thought you said, help me. You sure you're okay?
I'm fine, I said again. Probably shouldn't have skipped breakfast. Sean looked relieved, smiled, and shook his head.
Why do women do that?
Excitement of the day, I guess. We'd reached the tent, where a row of white-jacketed servers stood behind long tables, laden with silver dome-covered food. A reception line was taking shape. Shannon and Dakota, flanked by bridesmaids, groomsmen, Shannon's dad, Maureen's mother, and Dakota's grandmother. Poe was on Dakota's shoulder doing that head-bobbing thing. Shannon beckoned for Sean and me to join them.
"Guess we have to go shake hands with everyone," I said, reluctantly moving away from Pete and once again taking Sean's arm.
For the next 20 minutes we smiled and shook hands, posed for pictures, and greeted friends and strangers. Again, everything went precisely as planned. There really is something to this wedding planning business. Might be a good show topic after all. All of us in the wedding party were seated at a long banquet table overlooking clusters of smaller tables placed around the enclosure. The centerpieces we'd slaved over looked lovely, and there were fresh flowers everywhere. Thankfully, they were arranged in baskets, not black vases. Mr. Dumas, who still had Poe on his shoulder, stood.
"If you'll excuse me for a few minutes, folks," he said, "I think I'll put this good boy back in his aviary. All this food in plain sight might make him forget his manners."
"Bye, Poe," I said.
"Bye, honey,"
he said.
"See you later."
When the father of the bride returned, the congratulatory speeches began in earnest. Sean Madigan did a credible job of toasting the happy couple, and by the time the food was served, it was evident that Shannon's black-and-white wedding was a resounding success. The guests were invited to adjourn to the summer house, where the cutting of the wedding cake was to take place. We dutifully trooped out single file behind the bride and groom. Pete was able to sneak into line behind me, making me feel more comfortable as we approached the gazebo.
"Looks like Fabio is going to perform for us," Pete said.
The baker had exchanged his puffy tall chef's hat for the tall black magician's version. He stood at the entrance of the gazebo, bowing and smiling at the crowd. Shannon and Dakota took their spots beside the cake, posed for the still photographer, then cut the first two pieces and fed them ever so gently to one another. Dakota's grandmother took over the cake cutting, passing the slices of chocolate and vanilla deliciousness to waiting guests. Fabio moved to the grassy area in front of the structure and began creating fanciful animals from black and white balloons, then moved on to card tricks. He pulled an amazing number of black and white silk scarves from an astonished young man's ear, and produced paper roses like the one he'd given me in rapid succession, handing one to each woman guest in the crowd. I'd just joined the applause as Fabio took a well-deserved bow when I noticed the man sitting on the bench behind the wedding cake. He wore a tuxedo. I tugged on Pete's sleeve. "What's Christopher Rich doing here?" I asked.
"I don't know," Pete said. "I'll ask him."
I watched as Pete walked around the hexagonal structure, reached across the rail, and tapped Christopher Rich on the shoulder. They talked for a few seconds, nodded to one another, then Pete returned to my side. "What's up with that?" I asked. He looked the way he did in my vision. Dead.
"Rich is apparently the fabulous Fabio's mentor. At least he sells him all his magic equipment, so he's here to supervise. He wore the tux because he wants to blend in with the wedding crowd. Wasn't invited, apparently."
"Sounds like Chris," I said. "He likes to be where the action is, invited or not. Are you about ready to leave?"
"Thought you'd never ask."
"I want to tell Aunt Ibby we're going," I said, looking around for my aunt. "With everybody dressed in black or white, it's hard to tell who's who."
"Like one of those islands full of penguins," Pete said. "I'll wait for you right here near the cake. Wouldn't want you to go off with another penguin by mistake."
Never happen, I promised, and headed back to the white tent, where Aunt Ivy was in deep conversation with one of the chefs, trying to wheedle the recipe for the butternut squash soup everyone had raved about, while Mr. Pennington stood by patiently.
Marilee, she called as soon as she saw me. I was worried about you. You looked a bit under the weather. Are you feeling well?
I'm fine. Just a little headache. Pete and I are going to go along now.
Rupert and I will be right behind you. It was a lovely wedding, wasn't it?
Just about perfect. We're going to say goodbye to Shannon and Dakota. I'll see you at home. I hurried back to where Pete waited. We wished the couple happiness. I whispered a thank you to Shannon for leaving the key under the conch, and we headed for our cars. Mine was closest to the home, and Pete had parked the Crown Vic across the street.
I'll follow you home. I don't have to go to work for a couple of hours yet. Want to tell me about what you saw in those visions?
I do, Pete. I want to tell Aunt Ibby and River, too. I know why Bridget Bishop is so angry about whoever is killing witches.
Okay, babe. I'll see you there in a few minutes. Oops. Hold on.
He pulled his phone from his pocket.
It's the chief. Gotta take this.
He turned partly away from me, but I could still hear his part of the conversation.
Yes, sir, he said in his cop voice.
I watched his face as he listened to Chief Whaley.
I've got it, he said. Be right there.
He leaned into my open window.
Sorry, Lee. Something came up sooner than I thought it would. Chief has a search warrant for the Bagginstow's place. I'll call you as soon as I can. Love you. Bye.
He crossed the road at a dead run, and I heard the siren as he sped away toward Salem. I noticed that the green Toyota was still there, and wondered if Sean knew about the warrant. I drove home slowly, carefully, thoughtfully. The haunting pictures I'd seen on the vases were engraved on my mind. I hoped River could help me sort them out, and Aunt Ibby's always wise counsel would be welcome, too. I parked in the garage and decided that I'd ask to borrow the Buick for my planned midnight ride. The vet is much too recognizable. I knew that Orion, who always figures out which door I'll use, waited just inside the back hall. Aunt Ibby and Rupert Pennington had gone to the wedding in his car, so I didn't know whether or not my aunt was home yet. Unlocking the door and resetting the alarm system, I listened for sounds of activity from her rooms. All was silent. Orion and I climbed the stairs to my apartment. It was good to be home. There was a real sense of relief that my maid of honor duties had been fulfilled, that I'd contributed to what had turned out to be a picture-perfect wedding, except for the pictures no one but me had seen.
Chapter 49. I changed from gown to jeans and t-shirt, silver sandals to well-worn sneakers, and called River. In honor of Megan's funeral, Mr. Doan had given her a rare night off. They'd show a Best of Tarot Time rerun in her time slot, so she was probably awake. I needed to see what she thought about the vision. Besides that, I wanted to be sure she approved of my viewing Megan's ceremony from a distance. More important, how did she feel about my watching the return of Bridget Bishop's spellbook? My friend was wide awake.
How was the wedding? I'll bet it was beautiful, huh?
It was, and the weather was wonderful, too. You never know about that when you plan an outdoor wedding. But, River, I had a vision while I was there.
While you were at the wedding? With all those people around? What happened?
I told her in as much detail as I could remember, and I was pretty sure I remembered every terrifying second of it. When I finished, she was silent for a long minute.
Are you there, River? I asked. I'm here, she said,
and I realized that she was crying.
I'm here, but you were there, with her, with Bridget, during those awful days before they killed her.
That's what I thought, I told her. I saw through her eyes. I saw the girls who claimed she'd bewitched them. I even saw the judge who sentenced her. I saw the people who watched her die. No wonder she's angry. No wonder she sent the crows.
I don't think she's angry at me, after all, Rivers said. She's not even angry at Salem. She's angry at whoever is killing witches. Someone in Salem is acting as judge, jury, and executioner, and it's got to stop.
I'm glad you're not blaming yourself anymore, I said. I felt terrible about that.
I know. I'm glad, too. Did you tell Pete about what you saw in the vision? What does he think about it?
I haven't had a chance to tell Pete. He was going to follow me home from the wedding and try to help me figure it out. But he got a call from Chief Whaley to go right over to the Bagginstose mansion right after we left. Pete says the chief has a warrant.
A warrant? To search someplace? Or to arrest somebody?
I don't know. There wasn't time to ask questions. By the way, your friend Christopher Rich was there.
Huh. Some friend he turned out to be. I worry about him, you know, because of that phone call, but he's still a big jerk. I didn't realize he knew Shannon and Dakota that well.
As far as I know, he doesn't, I said. He told Pete he was there to help the fabulous Fabio with his magic act. All dressed up in a tux, too, so he'd blend in with all the other guests.
He doesn't want to blend. He likes to be the center of attention, she said. He's all upset now because he thinks he should be the one to carry Megan's ashes instead of me.
What makes him think that? You and Megan were so close.
He's more famous than I am. I'm just a little card reader, and he's a witch, a magician, a psychic, a shop owner. There've been magazine articles written about him. He's been interviewed on national TV. He was once king of the witch's ball. Blah, blah, blah. He says if he can't carry her ashes, he's just going to sit that part of the ceremony out.
Seems kind of childish, doesn't it?
Yep. And he doesn't even know about my returning the book to Bridget. That'll really frost him.
I want to talk to you about that, River, I said. About your returning the book, I mean. I know I can't be with you and the witches tonight because I'm not Wiccan, but if I can be in a place where I can see the ceremony from a distance, where I can't be seen by anyone else, is that okay with you?
You won't intrude in any way? We won't even see you?
Right.
No cameras of any kind? No recordings?
Right.
I don't see any reason why not, then. Just don't tell anyone I said so.
Thank you, River, I said. Maybe when this is over, Bridget can be at peace and move on to the Summerland with Megan.
I hope so, she said. With all my heart, I hope so.
Then she added, I hope she takes all those crows with her.
They'll go away, I promised.
I'm sure of it. Megan showed me.
And let me know about what's going on at that Bagginstose house, will you?
I always wondered what was in there. I told her that I'd call when I learned anything, and said goodbye. I wondered, too, what was in there that had caused Chief Whaley to move so fast. Orion darted suddenly through the cat door and out into the upstairs hall, so I knew that Aunt Ibby had come home. I followed the cat down the stairs, and we greeted her together.
"What a nice welcome home," she said. "Go on out to the kitchen, my dears, while I go upstairs and slip into something more comfortable. Then I want you to tell me more about what you saw at Claudine's house. All the details."
"I have a few pictures on my phone," I said. "I didn't take many, but it'll give you an idea of the clothes and hats and furniture I got to see. I'll run back upstairs and get it." I stopped in the downstairs hall to pick up my mail, and my aunt and I walked up the front stairs together. She and the cat to the second floor, me to the third. My phone was on the kitchen table where I'd left it after my talk with River. I slipped it into my jeans pocket, looked over the mail, flipped through the new issue of Motor Trend, and hurried back downstairs. My amazing aunt had already changed into a polka-dotted cotton dress and white Crocs, and started a pot of tea. Side by side at the kitchen counter, we looked at the photos I'd managed to take one by one. Here's what the closet looks like. A real walk-in with a state-of-the-art closet system. Track lighting, hanging rods, pull-out shelves, lingerie drawers, the whole deal, I said, pleased with the good quality of the picture taken so hurriedly.
Isn't that an old-fashioned dress form?
She asked, pointing.
My grandmother had one.
Remember?
It was in our attic before the fire.
I remember, I said. Look, I took a close-up of it. The two-piece suit on it fascinated me. Claudine's great-grandmother's waistline must have been about 18 inches.
It was the corsets, my aunt said. Cruel things. Women fainted a lot in those bad old days.
She leaned forward, peering closely at the photo.
Is that the secret panel behind the form? See, it's open just a crack.
That's it, I said. Sean had just pressed the button to open it when I took the shot.
Send these over to my computer, will you? I'd like to blow them up, see more detail.
Don't you want to see the hats? I asked.
Later. Come on down to my office. I think I see something interesting here.
She was already across the kitchen, on her way to her first floor room full of the high-tech gadgets she loves. I did as she asked, sent the photos, and hurried to catch up with her. What are we looking for? I asked.
Details, my dear. There's something interesting just inside that panel.
I'm not sure, but it may be important.
Did Pete see these pictures?
Just this one. I thought he might need to see where it's located in the house. Sean wouldn't let me photograph the guns behind it.
A person is allowed to have a gun collection, she said, as long as it's safely secured.
This one seems to be, I said. The photo of the partly open panel filled the screen. We could see parts of a few of the guns I'd seen hanging on the pegboard.
That's what I thought I saw, she said. And I bet that's what Pete saw, too.
I squinted at the screen. What is it? All I see is little parts of a whole bunch of guns. She touched the screen.
That one. It's so small you can see most of it. A Walther PPK.
Uh-huh. What about it?
It's a .380 caliber gun. It fires the bullets that fit those shells you found.
The mental light bulb went on over my head. I see. Someone in that house had access to the kind of gun that was fired at Christopher Rich.
Exactly, she said. Now, let's look at those hats.
Wait a minute. How do you know this stuff? About the gun?
Doctor No, she said. James Bond, 1962.
I should have guessed. Chapter 50. Aunt Ibby was right about the photo. Pete and Chief Whaley had spotted the small gun visible through the crack in the panel door. The search warrant had been obtained faster than Pete had thought it would be, which is why he'd had to leave so suddenly after the wedding. He called and gave me a hasty explanation of what was going on at the Bagginstow's house, and promised more details later.
But for now, he said, we're busy trying to locate Claudine Bagginstow's.
Claudine is missing? That was a surprise. Is Sean there? He might know what her plans were for the day.
He's here. Doesn't know where she is. She was here when we served the warrant. It kind of freaked her out. Sean was still at the wedding reception. Both cars are still here, hers and Elliot's. Anyway, like I said, she was crying and carrying on about the warrant. She excused herself to go to the bathroom and poof, disappeared.
I knew he didn't mean poof disappeared the way Megan and Bridget Bishop did in my visions. Didn't anyone see her leave?
Nope. There's a cop at every entrance. Chief is taking this gun thing seriously. We're clearing out the gun collection. There's at least one that's been fired recently.
The Walther PPK? I said. Surprised cop voice.
How'd you know that?
007, I said. James Bond used one.
Oh, he said, as though my answer made sense. Anyway, Sean says this house is so full of secret panels and hidden rooms and underground passages, she could be anywhere in here. He knows about them because of the hiding places they used for the stolen paintings. Claudine kind of got around to confiding in him about those lately. He's showing a couple of uniforms around the house right now. He has all her passwords, so we're going to see what's on her computer.
So he used Claudine's crush to get whatever he wanted. The location of the paintings and even her passwords. I wonder what else. I hope she's okay, I said. Will you let me know when you find her?
Sure I will. You still planning to go to that witch thing you were talking about?
I am. It'll be at midnight on the beach at the Dumas's place. I'll be safe and sound inside Shannon's room upstairs, watching from the window. No worries.
I know Megan was special to you, and you really want to be there for her funeral. Be careful driving, babe. I'll call you, even if it's late. Okay?
Okay. I hope Claudine's all right, and she's not guilty of anything too serious. The arthritis in her knee is pretty painful, I guess. And, Pete, don't forget about the hat pins.
I won't forget. Lethal-looking darn things, aren't they?
Sometimes I'm braver than I know, and sometimes I'm not smart enough to know when I should be scared to death. On my way from Salem to the beach at Marblehead that night, I was alternately excited about the Wiccan funeral I was about to witness and, at the same time, worried about what else I might see. Maybe Megan's return to the Earth, the beginning of her journey to the Summerland, was something a nosy reporter had no business watching. On the other hand, Megan had appeared in my visions, apparently happy to help me. The return of Bridget Bishop's book was something else. That was personal to me. After all, I was the one who'd more or less, however unwillingly, inherited it from Ariel Constellation. I was also the one who'd tried hard to destroy it. Maybe it was my fault that the long-dead witch had unleashed such fury on Salem. Even if it is my fault, I'm sure returning it to her is the right thing to do. I'd borrowed Aunt Ibby's Buick and left my house early, thinking it would be wise to get there before most of the witches showed up. There were several vacant sandy lots along the street leading to the Dumas's. Some of them had for sale signs, and none of them had no parking signs. I chose one where there were a few trees and slid the Buick in behind the biggest one. I locked the car and began the short walk to the beach. I was glad I'd brought a flashlight. There was no sidewalk, and I deliberately wore dark clothes. I hurried along on the side of the road, my feet sinking into soft sand. Very few cars passed, and I was increasingly aware that maybe this wasn't such a smart idea after all. Maybe when I'd assured Pete that I'd be in a safe place, I hadn't considered a lonely walk on a pitch-black road. When I reached the Dumas's property, there were already a few cars in the area where I'd parked the vet this morning. Mostly dark-colored Fords and Chevys. What had I expected? Brooms? I stayed well back in the shadows, skirting the edge of the house, not daring to use my light this close to the beach. I felt along the low wall surrounding the patio and found the conch shell. I slipped my hand under it and pulled out the key. On the beach below, I saw the beginnings of a fire and several figures silhouetted against the white sand. I fumbled for the lock and inserted the key, then exhaled a long sigh as I closed the door behind me, realizing that I'd been holding my breath. Feeling my way across the room, I struggled to remember where the stairway began. When I found it, I flipped the flashlight on and began to climb, holding on to the smooth maple banister all the way. Tripping and breaking a leg at this point would not be smart. Shannon had left the door to her room open for me, and a nightlight burned in the adjoining bathroom, giving enough light to keep me from bumping into the furniture. I turned the flashlight off and smiled when I saw that she'd pulled a chair up to the window. On a table, a bottle of Pepsi chilled in one of the aluminum ice buckets that had held champagne at the reception. She'd also left a toy telescope marked Pirates of the Caribbean. Good idea. I should have thought to bring binoculars. I picked up the telescope and focused it on the glow of the fire. Toy or not, it worked well enough to magnify the scene on the beach below. The walkway and altar were gone, as were the tent and all the tables and chairs. Not by